All right, well, in the interest of time, we're moving right on to the next, grab my first slide, please, the next session, and this will be on the neurobiological consequences of war. I'm Frances Jensen from Harvard Medical School and Children's Hospital, and I'm pleased to be able to present the following speakers. This session is going to be kicked off by the Honorable Max Cleland, who is currently Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission. I know Patrick did introduce you ahead of time, but I just, for those of you that don't know of his really remarkable past, he is a Vietnam vet himself and was seriously wounded in combat and awarded both Bronze Star for meritorious service and Silver Star for gallantry in action. And he's also been on the President Jimmy Carter, appointed him to head the Veterans Administration, and he's also been on the seat at the Senate Armed Services Committee in the past, as well as just being an incredible champion for a veteran. So I'd like us all to welcome him, and we'll hear his inspiring statements.
Well, sitting here listening to Lee's presentation as a single guy, it's probably good that the world does not respond to my thoughts. I wouldn't be invited back. May I say, I really didn't get wounded in Vietnam. I just went duck hunting and didn't change it. So, I want to thank Patrick and Steve for the yeoman service that they have rendered. Pulling all this together, I'm reminded of a great researcher, Casey Stengel, who said in attempting to be a baseball manager and researching that thoroughly, he said, it's easy to get the players. It's tough to get them to play together. And that's just the way it is. Whether it's baseball, you're going to Fenway Park tonight, or the military or government, especially the United States Congress, it's tough to get them to play together. We all seem to be very much engaged in our own thing, and that's not necessarily bad. But the consequences of balkanization are too expensive to contemplate. Especially when you're dealing with an individual which is one person. You are challenged to bring together your talents into a one-mind focus, and I understand that. But quite frankly, you're dealing not with just the mind, but with the whole person. I can remember when I was struggling and I was in the Senate and I went to the Capitol physician. I gave him a line from Maimonides, one of the founders of, I would imagine, modern medicine. And the quote is this: treat the patient first and then the disease. So what you're dealing with here when you're talking to or about people who have been to war, the first thing to understand is what someone once said, that there are no unwounded warriors. There are no unwounded warriors. Nobody comes back from war unchanged or unwounded. They are wounded in many ways, I can tell you. First of all, the physical wounds. When I was wounded in Vietnam, obviously, the first thing that had to be done was to save my life. And that was, quite frankly, pretty much a miracle at the time due to the fact that I was 5 inches from the grenade when it went off, losing my legs and my right arm virtually instantly. Had I not been so close to the grenade and the flash burn that seared the flesh and stopped me from bleeding so profusely, I would have died right there. Helicopter evacuation 43 years ago to a Quonset hut, which was my ICU, helped save my life. And five doctors looked over me, and the orthopedic surgeon that led the effort never came to see me because he couldn't face the fact, he told me later, of what he had been having to do. So the first effort is to save the life, and you've got to deal with that physical nature of the wound. And I spent another year and a half in military and VA hospitals dealing with all that. And the effort back in those days, a whole generation ago, was to focus on the physical wound. And that was what I thought I had. Basically, a physical wound. I had no idea that being that close to the grenade, I might be the victim of what we now call traumatic brain injury. It's probably why I became a Democrat. But we really don't know, do we? So, the focus at Walter Reed in those days was physical, and there were plenty of casualties to deal with. It was more than a triage effort, but it was pretty much heal them up, get them as well as you can, and move them out, bring the next one in for that bed. I've been in that situation. I had no idea for years, for decades, that I might have some kind of something called post-traumatic stress disorder. In other words, if I got home, okay, you made it. You're alive. You're okay. You can now move on with your life. And a certain level of that is actually true. And I think as long as you're relatively young and you got your life to look forward to and you can look forward to some things and you're doing some things that provide some sense of meaning and purpose in your life, you're able to, quote, overcome. My first book was something called Strong at the Broken Places, after a Hemingway line called, he said, the world breaks us all, and afterward many are strong at the broken places. And there are ample examples of that. Hemingway wrote that line after World War I, where he was wounded, almost lost a leg. He understood the wounding. But ultimately, Hemingway committed suicide. We all know that. He took to drink, and so the hell did I. I guarantee you. And I had a hell of a lot of fun with it. So that when I wound up in my little apartment in Washington, I had only two things in my little ice box in that little apartment while I was going to the VA every day. Daiquiri mix and wild turkey. That was it. That was the total amount of sustenance that I had. Later, I realized there was something called psychic numbing, that there was a loss of dopamine with the traumatic injury and all this kind of stuff. I didn't know all that stuff. I didn't know it. I had a life. I was going to go live it. And I lived it to the best of my ability. Thank God I wound up dating an alcoholic, a lady who wound up getting me into open AA meetings, and I didn't want the pain of dealing with her, so I not only quit her, I quit drinking at 75. Thank God. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So basically, my life was lived at a high level of meaning and purpose. It was Dr. Viktor Frankl who survived the death camps in World War II, who stood only 1 in 28 chances of survival, who said that to live is to suffer, to survive is to find meaning in suffering. He came up with a whole concept of logotherapy, logos, the whole sense of which, why we are here. He used to quote Nietzsche, that if I understand the why, I can put up with almost any how. So people who overcome especially physical injuries, near-death experiences, difficulties in life, who overcome them, usually do it by means of having some kind of meaning and purpose in their lives. I had a strong meaning and purpose. It was called politics, government service, public service. One of my inspirational leaders was that turned me on was JFK, John F. Kennedy. I find it interesting, 50 years later from the moonshot speech, that there was a Kennedy that gave us the moonshot speech, and there was a Kennedy helped put us together today for the inner space journey, the next frontier. Now, all of this rolls along pretty well if you've got a powerful sense of meaning and purpose and a sense of the why in your life. Why did God save me on the battlefield? Save me on the battlefield so that I could turn, as Dr. Shuler says, my pain into somebody else's gain, my hurts into halos and all that kind of stuff. And I believed all that. I do believe all that. But then I lost. I lost my sense of meaning and purpose and destiny and vision. And at that point, then the reality of the wounding came into play. Then I realized only recently that I was dealing with something that was much bigger than I was. And that was the basic fundamental aspect of your brain. I'm a basic workaholic, so I use the cerebral cortex all the time. If I can't figure it out, well, there's something wrong. I mean, the world, I got to figure this out, you know? Well, truth of the matter is, that's not really how life works, is it? But, you know, you can go a long way leading a life like that, and I did. But we have other parts of the brain, do we not? We have a part of the brain that is somewhere referred to in the last few weeks that I've been reading and coming to prepare to share with you. A part of the reptile portion of our brain that is only about 100 million years old. That's pretty basic. War drives you back to the most basic aspects of your life, the most basic aspects of your survival, and right back to the most fundamental aspects of you even being alive. That has been equated to being a 1,000-pound horse, a 1,000-pound steed upon which you ride if you have your life in balance. But if your life gets out of balance, if your limbic system doesn't have enough connectivity and you don't have enough love and support in your life, and if you can't figure things out anymore and you lose your sense of meaning and purpose, whoa, baby. For those who have been wounded, whether they have been physically wounded or not, whether when they have been traumatized, that old horse, that 1,000-pound steed in your mind has been spooked. It has been spooked. And if it has been spooked numerous times, it ain't ever forgetting. And so anything that comes along and spooks that horse, we call it triggers nowadays, then you're off and running. You're liable to be thrown off the horse and dragged along the ground. So, after I lost my sense of meaning and purpose, I went down into a massive, deep, dark depression, sparked by massive anxiety and what we now know, flooding of adrenaline and cortisol into the system. And all of that stuff came flooding back from 40-some-odd years ago, just like I was on the battlefield again, dying, overwhelmed, overcome. So, after several years of treatment and counseling and understanding trauma and all of this, I have come to believe that it is so important for all of you all to get together, to have you meet from time to time, certainly over the next 10 years, Patrick and Steve, to compare notes. It's easy to get the players. It's tough to get them to play together. but we must have you play together. Because those who have the soldier's mind, as it was called after the Civil War, shell shock, as it was called after World War I, combat fatigue, as it was called after World War II, PTSD, as we in the Veterans Administration finally called it in 1978, and it's made its way into the manuals in 1980. Those who have post-traumatic stress disorder that interrupts their life, and they run across triggers all the time that generate the initial trauma. It is as if they are going through it again. So it sparks the massive flood of adrenaline and cortisol that takes your emotions down. I guarantee you, I've been wounded in many ways, but the worst way is to have your mind go. People used to come in and look at me and want to read and say, well, at least you've got your mind. I'm thinking, yeah, okay, all right, we'll go with that. But when, unbeknownst to you, and unbeknownst to your understanding of who you are and what has happened to you, other things happen to you that take you down, that make you the person that you were never knew you were, that actually are in control of you, when that horse is dragging you along and is spooked, boy, that is a terrifying place. And that most primitive part of our brain pulls down the limbic part, the emotional part, and you go down like a rock. And it also begins pulling down the cerebral part. I got to where, in the deepest parts of my depression, I could not read. Now, I realized when I went to college down at Stetson University that I was bilingual. I spoke Southern and a little English. So they slapped me in remedial English. So by God, I learned how to read. I want you to know. I'm damn proud of it. So when I got to be about 4 or 5 years ago, unable to read and think, I was really totally disabled. Thank God, with patient help, trauma counseling at Walter Reed, some chemicals actually provided or mentioned by a doctor at Brown University, matter of fact, antidepressant for a while, I began to recover, and I am beginning to restore my sense of self and all these other things. And then, you know, magically the emotions come back and the cerebral capability comes back, and then you begin thinking about meaning and purpose. You begin thinking about the ability to survive, the whys in life and so forth. And many times those are God-given. You can find meaning in work, you can find meaning in relationships, you can find meaning just in being. So that's been my journey. But those of us who have made that journey, and hundreds of thousands, really millions of young Americans who have put their lives on the line for the rest of us, need you. We need you. So we thank you for coming to this conference. As JFK said many, many years ago in his inaugural address, the energy, the faith, and the vision that we bring to this endeavor can light our nation and all who serve it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for such a passionate description of the visible and invisible consequences of war. And we certainly understand why you champion for for the veterans of this country. Thank you so much. So we're going to go through, actually, the whole parts of this spectrum, which is too much, obviously, to ever cover in a single symposium. But we're going to hear about post-traumatic stress disorder, for which he mentioned neuropathic pain, and then some of the more physical wounds and the future of our research and treatment in those areas. So our first scientific speaker is Dr. Elizabeth Phelps, who is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. Her work is on cognitive development, learning, memory, and understanding how human learning and memory are changed by emotion and stress. And we will hear about the post-traumatic stress disorder, the mechanisms.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. Can I have the slides? Thank you. So that was a great introduction to PTSD. I'm not sure I really need to speak, but I'm going to anyways. So just to start with a few facts of PTSD. So as you already know, PTSD is a significant risk with war. Estimates of the risk of PTSD for combat veterans range from 10 to 30%, suggesting up to a third of veterans may suffer lasting symptoms of PTSD. And just to bring this home, if we look at these soldiers working together in the conflict in the Middle East, it's very likely at least one of them will come home with a debilitating mental disorder that prevents him from moving forward with a normal functional life. And I think the next, you know, I was going to just briefly talk about the symptoms of PTSD, but I think what you heard from Senator Cleland is essentially a great demonstration of that. So just to briefly say, there are three classes. One is related to re-experiencing the trauma, and that's the flashbacks that you've heard about. Another is due to, is essentially avoidance, and this is related to feeling emotionally numb, but also depressed and losing interest in enjoyable activities. And the final is physical hyperarousal, difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating, being easily startled, and feeling on edge essentially all the time. And although many people have these types of symptoms when they experience a traumatic event, for most of us, they will go away, but with PTSD, they persist. And for some people, these symptoms may not be apparent immediately, but may actually emerge over time. So it's clear that PTSD is a major and devastating consequence of war, but the question for today is how can advances in brain science help address this issue? Brain science today is developing detailed models of the neurobiology of fear that are providing a basis for understanding PTSD. So in my talk, I first want to briefly review what we've learned about the basic neurobiology of fear, and then I want to move on to how this fear circuitry may be altered with PTSD. And then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about how advances in brain science are starting to suggest new and innovative approaches to the treatment of PTSD. So I want to introduce you to three brain systems that we know play an important role in PTSD, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how they interact in normal fear and then with PTSD. So the first is the amygdala. I think this is probably what was referred to as the horse in the last comment. The amygdala is a small structure in the medial temporal lobe, about the size of the tip of your thumb, and it gets its name from the word almond, which you can see somewhat in this graphic. The second is the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is a large portion of the brain, and particularly large in humans. There are several subregions of the prefrontal cortex that we think play a role in the neurobiology of fear. And finally, the hippocampus. The hippocampus is deep in the medial temporal lobe, and it's primarily known for its role in memory and the formation of sort of conscious or what we call episodic memories. So let's just start with how we might study fear in other species, and then how we can extend this to understanding fear in everyday human life. So this is a typical paradigm that's used in the neurobiology of fear, and it's classical fear conditioning, and it's learning fear through association, much in the way Pavlov describes. So this rat here hears a tone and has no particular emotional reaction to the tone, but after the tone is paired with shock a few times, the tone itself comes to elicit a range of fear responses, such as freezing, increases in blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, and stress hormone release. We can do something very similar in humans. I can bring you to the laboratory and give you something neutral like a blue square. I can pair it with a mild shock to the wrist. And after a few pairings, the blue square itself comes to elicit a range of fear responses. Research on the amygdala has suggested that the amygdala is critical for the acquisition, storage, and expression of the of this type of fear memory, and particularly the bodily expression, the fear response as expressed through your body. We know in humans, if you stimulate the amygdala, and these are pre-surgery epilepsy patients who have electrodes in the amygdala, it leads to feelings of anxiety and arousal. And importantly, in humans, when you learn these fears, you don't necessarily need to have painful circumstances. So in humans, we can learn fears through observation, just watching others. We can also learn fears through language. And interestingly, the amygdala seems to play an equal role in these fears learned through social communication, and that's demonstrated here by showing a robust amygdala responses when you're watching somebody else go through a fear learning procedure. So humans, we have social means of acquiring fear, and they can be just as powerful as actual physical pain. So we know the amygdala is important in creating fear memories, but the question we really want to know is how do we get rid of fear memories? So if we go back to the basic paradigms we can use in the laboratory, you can acquire a fear by presenting a neutral stimulus such as a blue square and pair with a shock. And if you want to now get rid of that fear, you can present the blue square a number of times by itself without ever presenting a shock, and eventually the person's going to learn that the blue square no longer predicts shock. This type of safety learning we call extinction. And what we know from a number of studies is that in extinction learning, we actually didn't erase the original memory. The original memory still seems to be stored in the amygdala. But what we've now done is created a second memory, suggesting that this event, this, in this case, this blue square, is now safe, that then can compete with expression with the original fear memory. And this is when the prefrontal cortex comes into place. So the prefrontal cortex is necessary to inhibit the amygdala so that now you can express this extinction memory, you can express this safety learning. And there's a particular region of the prefrontal cortex, the ventral-medial prefrontal cortex here in yellow, that has extensive connectivity with the amygdala and plays a role in inhibiting the amygdala when the fear is no longer appropriate. In addition, in humans, we can also use our thoughts to think about fearful events differently. We can convince ourselves or reinterpret a situation so that we no longer experience the fear. And when we use our thoughts to control fears, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex here in green engages this circuitry of fear inhibition to now inhibit the amygdala and inhibit the expression of the fear. So the prefrontal cortex plays a role in a number of ways in diminishing our fear response. And finally, the hippocampus. The hippocampus is important in memory, and it works in conjunction with the amygdala in forming strong conscious memories of the emotional events at the time they occur. But importantly, it also provides a context to this bodily expression of the fear memories. And it works with the prefrontal cortex to inhibit the expression and fear of fear when the person is now in a safe place. So it's appropriate, for instance, to have a fear response when you hear a loud noise in the battlefield because it might be a gun. It's not appropriate to have a fear response when you hear a loud noise walking down the streets of Boston when it might be a car backfiring. And the hippocampus tells you what the appropriate context is and what the appropriate context is not. So what I suggested to you so far is that there's this delicate balance between these brain systems. The amygdala teaches you what to fear and leads to this physiological expression of fear. However, when we learn that the previous feared objects or events are now safe, the prefrontal cortex inhibits the amygdala and the fear memory to express the safe learning. And the hippocampus can also inhibit the amygdala to express that this is not the right place to have a fear response, that now you're in a safe situation. So what about with PTSD? We have this basic understanding of the neurobiology of fear, and it's starting to point to ways in which this basic understanding is now altered with PTSD. So let's start with the amygdala. Brain imaging studies of patients with PTSD show that the amygdala shows an exaggerated response to emotional stimuli. So here is just a slide I took from a paper from Lisa Shin's lab at Tufts University, and she presented negative scenes to patients with PTSD and normal control subjects, and the PTSD patients show an exaggerated amygdala response. We also know that the amygdala response may not differentiate fear from safety signals. So it's normal to show a robust amygdala response when you encounter a fear stimulus. It's not normal to show a robust amygdala response when you encounter a safe stimulus. And in PTSD, the amygdala does not always differentiate these two. And finally, stress hormones, which are part of the natural response that we see with PTSD, enhance amygdala function. So it's almost as if stress hormones are priming the amygdala to acquire fears more strongly and to enhance the fear response. This influence of stress hormones on the amygdala is in contrast to the influence of stress hormones on the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. So prolonged exposure to stress hormones impairs function of the hippocampus, and both acute and prolonged exposure to to stress hormones impairs function of the prefrontal cortex. One consequence of this, we think, is that you actually see smaller hippocampi, reduced hippocampi volume, when patients are suffering from PTSD. And even though these patients tend to show very robust memories of the events, the traumatic events, that they don't seem to be able to forget, after they acquire PTSD, they show relatively poor memory function in everyday life. And the ventral medial prefrontal cortex as well, this brain region that's important for inhibiting the amygdala, also shows less activity with PTSD. And that's demonstrated here in a study from Mohammed Malad conducted here at MGH, where he shows reduced activity in the ventral medial prefrontal cortex when a patient with PTSD learns to extinguish a fear response relative to a normal control subject. So what I've suggested to you so far is that in normal fear, there's this delicate balance between these brain systems that assures that the fears are expressed when there's a real threat, but when the threat has passed and now you know the situation is safe, or when the context is safe, the fear is inhibited. What we think is happening in PTSD, based on this model, is that this balance is disrupted. So the amygdala now has a stronger influence on the expression of behavior, and it is not as easily inhibited by these other circuits that play a role in the neurobiology of fear. So I want to now just briefly move on to what the current treatments of PTSD are, and then highlight how the research that we're conducting now is leading to potential innovations of treatments. So currently, the standard treatment for PTSD is psychotherapy, and this includes cognitive restructuring, so using your thoughts to now interpret situations differently, and exposure therapy, so coming up with the traumatic memory over and over again until you now no longer experience the fear response to the same degree, and this is based on the principle of extinction. And this is successful, but it relies on the prefrontal cortex, which may be affected by stress. So it may be harder for somebody with PTSD to actually use these techniques than somebody not suffering from PTSD. A second primary treatment is medication, primarily antidepressants, but also anti-anxiety medications. Antidepressants can support the brain systems impaired by stress and aid in psychotherapy, but used alone, they often will treat the symptoms without necessarily addressing the underlying problems or dysfunction. And one of the things about current treatments is that they are successful for memory for many people, but they're not successful for everyone. And we really want to understand how we can treat everybody who suffers from PTSD. And these treatments can be a long process, and the patient needs to be committed to the treatment for it to be successful. So finally, to wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about how advances in the neurobiology of fear can improve PTSD outcomes. And there really are two approaches that are emerging. The first is understanding resilience, and the second is innovations in treatment. So as I mentioned, about up to a third of combat veterans will show symptoms of PTSD, but this means at a minimum about 70% of people who experience trauma do not develop PTSD. And the question is, can we identify who they are? And there's a number of factors that we know may be linked to resilience, and we really have to understand how these work. And these include prior life experience, genetic variation, neural vulnerabilities, or perhaps such as traumatic brain injury, or perhaps natural variation in neural structures, social support, and all of these, of course, can work in combination with the nature of the trauma to promote resilience or not. And finally, you know, if we understand what makes somebody resilient, we could do one of two things. We could either not let those people who are vulnerable be exposed to the to combat situations, or perhaps we can develop new treatments that we can now make those vulnerable populations less vulnerable. So what about innovations in treatment? There's really a few different approaches that are being tried right now for innovations in treatment. One is to look at cognitive enhancements that augment exposure therapy, and a great example of this is the research of decycloserine done by Mike Davis, Carrie Russell, and Barbara Rothbaum, showing by doing basic research in rats, they were able to show that decycloserine enhances extinction learning, and we now know that this may aid and facilitate exposure therapy. And so these are drugs that you do not take chronically. You only take them at the time of therapy. There's research looking at enhancing training or pharmacological support in the field to prevent traumatic memories. So after a trauma occurs, it may be the case that we can now prevent that trauma from turning into PTSD. And here people are experimenting with anti-anxiety medications or beta blockers. And finally, there's a new wave of techniques that we're looking to actually target fear memories. And particularly, we're looking at, can we target the restorage of fear memories after they're retrieved to perhaps actually disrupt the fear representation in the amygdala? I'm going to skip my example of that for the sake of time, but I just want to conclude by saying that I hope that I convinced you today that basic research on the neurobiology of fear provides a basis for understanding altered fear processing in PTSD, and that brain studies of fear are just beginning to yield exciting new insights into why PTSD occurs and how we can most effectively treat it. And it is my hope that with the continued efforts of basic and applied research in brain science over the next decades in the future, when we see soldiers like this, we can be fairly confident that none of them will suffer the debilitating effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that all of our soldiers who survive the physical risks of war have the happy homecoming and bright future they so deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Clifford Wolf, who is going to be talking about the neuropathic mechanisms of neuropathic pain. Dr. Wolf is a professor of neurology and neurobiology at Harvard Medical School and also director of the program in neurobiology at my institution, Children's Hospital, Boston. He is an expert on the molecular mechanisms of pain and pain hypersensitivity, as well as studies looking at genetic screens to determine whether there are genetic risks for increased pain susceptibility.
In his opening address this morning, Steve Hyman mentioned Steve Hyman this morning introduced the disability the burden of different diseases that affect the U.S. population, highlighting the contribution of neuropsychiatric disturbances. Missing from the list of the diseases was, in fact, the commonest cause of complaint of why patients go to see their physicians, and that happens to be pain. And if any of you know someone who suffers from severe neuropathic pain, typically described as, for example, of having a limb in boiling hot water, or such exquisite sensitivity that they cannot wear a shirt on their body, we need to ask ourselves the question, why do we feel pain? And in fact, the answer to this has now come from recent insights into the genetic underpinnings of pain. And in the same way that we have learned from rare mutations of single genes with a strong penetrance, as we've discussed earlier today, there are a loss of function mutations in a single ion channel, NaV1.7, which results in a condition called congenital insensitivity to pain, where the individuals are born unable to feel any pain at all. Now, in one hand, that enables you to perform party tricks, but it also reveals why pain is so important, because individuals who have this condition damage themselves. The tips of their fingers are destroyed because the way in which we interact in the environment is to explore it. When they drink coffee, they are unable to tell the difference between warm coffee or boiling hot coffee, and in fact, their life expectancy is reduced. So one of the prime evolutionary drives for pain is as a protective mechanism, a mechanism by means of which we can detect noxious stimuli, and this enables us to protect ourselves from danger. And this kind of pain we call nociceptive pain. I illustrate Descartes' view of how this pain was generated, the 17th century view. We now have a much greater insight, including exactly which proteins react to noxious stimuli and convert these noxious stimuli into electrical signals that activate the pain system. But injury is not always avoidable, obviously. And we have made enormous progress in promoting survival, and we heard from Senator Cleland in his particular case. And this has obviously been one of the wonders of modern military medicine. We have heard something about the great advances of rehabilitation, and we'll hear more about that in a moment. But in fact, an area that has really lagged behind relates to the pain associated with combat injury. The best current figures that I was able to get that after amputation, something like 50% of patients have persistent severe pain, and even traumatic brain injury is associated with very high levels of pain. What is important, and I'll come back to this in a moment, is that individuals with apparently identical injuries do not always develop pain. Some individuals do, and some individuals do not. And this is something that we need to explore. Now, this year happens to be the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, and indeed, war injuries were very prevalent then. And indeed, the father of American neurology, Silas Weir Mitchell, was the first to really recognize neuropathic pain as a syndrome. And his description here is really one of the best in terms of the manifestation and presentation of neuropathic pain, the exquisite sensitivity that it produces, the suffering, and the way in which this condition creates a state of heightened sensitivity, stimuli that normally would be innocuous now produce very severe pain. So what exactly is neuropathic pain? Well, for a long time, we've considered pain merely as a symptom, but in fact, that is incorrect. We now know that injuries to the nervous system change the nervous system, and that neuropathic pain is actually a disease state of the nervous system that is produced by the injury. We've heard a lot about plasticity this morning and how plasticity is important in terms of the development of certain functions, and we need to appreciate, though, that while plasticity is a critical component of how the brain enables us to learn and to retain information, that the same modifiability of the nervous system can also contribute to disease states. And indeed, that is exactly what neuropathic pain is. It is a maladaptive plasticity due to increase in the excitability of neurons in the pain pathway, as well as a loss of the inhibitory controls that normally modulate this pain pathway. And indeed, we now appreciate, we've just heard about post-traumatic stress disorder, that some of the same amplification signals that occur in neuropathic pain contribute to the symptoms in PTSD. So we now appreciate that there is a disturbance in the function of the nervous system that generates the chronic pain. What I specifically want to address today, though, is that issue of why one individual feels more pain than another and even more so, why one individual transitions from acute to chronic pain and another does not. And this really is another way of expressing why is there a variation in pain sensitivity from the stoic individual who can endure pain to the individual who feels pain enormously. And that really relates to a theme that was addressed in the symposium we just heard, but in this case related to pain. And the specific question is, are there genetic determinants of the pain variance in this spread of sensitivity, or as well as this this risk of the susceptibility of developing pain? And indeed, Weir Mitchell, who I previously introduced you as having first identified neuropathic pain, also identified another disease known as Mitchell's disease, which is called erythromelalgia. And this is a condition where pain occurs spontaneously, and individuals have burning red limbs, typically the lower limbs, which they feel feels like the limbs are on fire. And this is actually due to a gain-of-function mutation in exactly the same channel that caused the congenital insensitivity to pain. So we have channelopathies where loss of function results in complete analgesia, and a gain of function causing abnormal excitability in this ion channel can produce a severe pain. This, however, is a very rare mutation, and the question we really need to address, and again, the parallels with the psychiatric disorders are very strong here, are there common genetic determinants of pain? And the way we approach it is very similar to the way in which the previous speakers looked at bipolar disease and schizophrenia. We use a classic genetic approach to see if the phenotype, in this case, neuropathic pain, whether it is heritable or not. And there are two ways we can do this. We can use twins. We've heard something about that. We can compare the pain experience of identical and non-identical twins and see from that whether there is a heritable component, and we can do the same thing in inbred mouse strains. And in fact, if you look at these two models, the estimates are that something conservatively around 50% of the variation in pain sensitivity is heritable, in other words, driven by our genetic polymorphisms. So the question then is how we can find these pain genes. And the way in which we've tried to do this is to use three different approaches. One is to use the powerful model organism of the fruit fly, where we can selectively knock down every single one of their genes only in neurons and see if this changes their behavior. And believe it or not, we can actually model something like pain in the fruit fly. We can also study changes in rodents, which enables us also to look at which genes are switched on and off in various pain-related conditions. And we too can look at humans to look at the variants in genes to see if these are associated with either increased or decreased risk of development of pain. I'd like to just illustrate one of the genes that we've identified using this approach. It's a gene called GCH1, and this happens to be a gene that we've studied in the context of prolapsed intervertebral disc. So in these patients, in a group of patients who've had a disc prolapse such that it now protrudes on their spinal root and producing radicular pain or sciatica, we can ask whether there are variations in this variants of this GCH1 gene which are associated with more or less pain. When we looked at all the common variants of this gene and averaged the pain score of these patients after they had surgery to remove this prolapsed intervertebral disc, the mean score, which was a measure of pain at rest, pain on movement, was, as you can see here, about 0.7. But one of the common variants of this gene, all the patients had a score of 0.4, which is half that. So we looked at this in a little bit more closely, and identifying this particular variant of the GCH1 gene, those individuals who had two copies of this gene, which are about 2% in of us, had a very low pain score indeed. Those who had one copy, which are about 15% of us, had a pain score which was about half of the most of the population, and then the wild-type individuals who had no copies of this gene had high pain scores. When we set out to do this genetic study of neuropathic pain, we were looking for pain-enhancing genes. Our whole mindset was there were certain genes that would increase the risk of developing pain, and the first gene we discovered was one that appears to be pain-protective. Now, in some respects, you may say this may be a useful way of recruiting soldiers. You identify those who have two copies of their pain-protective haplotype and make sure they go into the Navy SEALs. But that apart, we can learn from this because it happens GCH1 is an enzyme. And what we can attempt now to do is to see whether we can pharmacologically manipulate those individuals who do not have this pain-protective haplotype by inhibiting their enzyme to convert them, if you like, into those individuals who have higher pain, have a reduced risk of developing pain. And this is clearly one of the important outcomes from such genetic research. We, too, have done a genome-wide association studies in neuropathic pain. And surprisingly, for such a complex phenotype, which has so many confounding factors, mood, the nature of the disease, of the injury, the different treatments that have been applied, we do see relatively strong signals in a few genes. And in fact, in our first study, we've found that there were SNPs in four genes that seem to predict the 10% of chronic neuropathic pain patients who had the most severe pain. So we feel that we can use these polymorphisms in these particular genes as a way of identifying who's at risk, and we are currently replicating this in additional cohorts. So in summary, I think it is clear that pain has a very strong heritable component and that we can identify those genes that that are responsible for a high susceptibility in some individuals and not others for the development of chronic pain. From that, we should be able to develop algorithms that will tell us who's at risk of developing pain, and that obviously is going to be enormously important in terms of therapy. If we know who has a high risk of developing pain, the treatment may be quite different from those individuals who have a low risk. But even more important is that we can interrogate this genetic information to identify those genes that confer high or low risks of developing pain and use this as a way of identifying novel targets for the development of new treatments for both preventing and reversing neuropathic pain. To end up, again, a common theme that many speakers have identified is that one of the most exciting new technologies is our capacity using stem cell technology to convert patients' skin cells, fibroblasts, into different neurons by driving them down a particular cell fate differentiation process. We, too, have been doing this, working with the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, and we have been able to make pain neurons, if you like, neurons that have human neurons that have the capacity, sensory neurons that have the capacity to respond to the stimuli that that would normally activate them and initiate the pain sensation. These neurons, if we recall from them, fire action potentials. They express the ion channels and other proteins that we know are responsible or contribute to their role in the pain system. And this will be enormously useful for the screening of novel analgesics. It, too, also offers the possibility of personalized pain medicine, where instead of treating all patients with a particular drug, we will be able to match for the individual their risk of developing pain and to test which are the drugs that will act in the most efficacious way in them. What has been particularly exciting, I think, is that we now understand an enormous amount about the nature of pain. We have a lot more to understand, but I think it is clear to me, at least, that by looking at the neurobiology of pain, we are at a point now where we can foresee, and in the same spirit of this moonshot, that within a reasonable period of time, it is likely that we will be able to intervene to prevent the development of chronic persistent pain, which is such an awful outcome of injury, particularly in the context of battle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Clifford. All right, before I introduce our last speaker, I just wanted to say that don't worry, the buses aren't leaving at 5:45. We will all get to Fenway. The buses will wait for 15 minutes after the conference closes. They will leave. So we've got plenty of time, so don't worry. Don't start packing up yet. The next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Ling, Colonel Jeffrey Ling, who is a program manager of Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, for those of you who did not know. He has an extraordinary portfolio, including revolutionizing prostheses, fracture putty, preventing violent explosive neurotrauma, restoring plasticity and acceleration after recovery, and also serves as chairman of the neurology at the Uniform Sciences Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. So we welcome you to this.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for allowing me this opportunity to share with you and represent a constituency of patients who truly, truly need all of your help. And so I'm very excited about this symposium, and I'm hoping that it is really a jump off to be the next frontier. Truly, I do. Thank you. So I'm going to talk to you about traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury. Fundamentally, it's fairly straightforward to figure out what the basis of this is. It's injury to the brain or spinal cord caused by physical force. This is where physics meets biology. And this is fundamentally a biomechanical failure of the biological system because of the forces that are applied to it. Now, it's been described, as you can see on this board here, TBI, traumatic brain injury, and SCI, spinal cord injury, have very defined terms that are associated with mild, moderate, severe, or the ASIA, that is the American Spine Injury Association scores, A through E, that are largely based upon the level of disability a patient suffers after they've had their injurious event. But that doesn't tell the story. Really, the story is told by the patients. You heard from Senator Cleland, who gave a very eloquent speech. Let me introduce you to a couple of more. This is a patient of mine in Iraq when I was running the ICU at the 86th Combat Support Hospital. This is a patient who was on foot patrol. He went ahead and he saw what looked like a hole in the ground. He knew that it was trouble. He told his fellows to back up. He started back up. The insurgency exploded it. He was blown off his feet. He did not lose consciousness, but he was confused for at least 15 minutes. So he suffered a mild traumatic brain injury, or what we would call a grade 2 concussion. He was brought to the combat support hospital. CT scan was normal. Neurologic exam was normal. And most people would say he was normal. He felt normal. In reality, he was not normal. This is the hidden injury of the war, as we had talked about. In fact, on closer inspection, we found that he could not do a digit span, he could not do wordless generation. Fundamentally, he had cognitive processing problems. So I kept him behind the wire for a little while. He pestered me every day to go back to duty. And so finally, after a couple of days, he cleared up completely. I kept him for a couple more days. And then finally, to get him out of my hair, I sent him back to duty. But here is a classic example of a patient who doesn't know they're hurt, but they really are hurt. The next patient is a little more obvious. This is a fellow who was actually a contractor. He was actually one of the cooks at our dining facility. He was walking across the compound one day, and a mortar round came in, and we got mortar fairly regularly, but he got too close to an explosion, got struck by a fragment, and in fact suffered a pretty significant brain injury, as you can see by his CAT scans that show you the tract of the fragment as it plowed through his brain, the swelling and all that. He was taken brought to us. He was taken to the OR by my good friend Colonel Jim Mecklen, who did a debridement of the wound. He went to the ICU. We took good care of him. And as you can see, 14 days later, he's fine. In the old days, this is a patient that some people would call expectant. And we now realize that traumatic brain injury is not a disease that we should treat nihilistically, but rather it is a treatable disease. And so this fellow, as you can see, had no neurologic deficit, and in fact, actually went back to cooking. Sadly, his cooking wasn't any better than it was, and he probably should have had the injury on the other side of his brain, and maybe it would have been better, but that's for another day. The last patient that I want to show you on the TBI is a severe TBI. This is an Iraqi police officer who was on a mounted patrol. He was driving his police car. He went under an underpass. An IED exploded next to his head. And you can see that he clearly has a severe injury. With that pulpy mass that you see extruding from him is actually brain coming out of the head. He has no eye anymore. He's very well banged up. Looks terrible, I know. This is clearly a patient that in the old days they would have said that is expectant, but he is not. We actually took care of him. He had a very rocky course for about 10 days, but at the end of 10 days, he suddenly woke up. One morning we came in, he woke up, was following commands, took the breathing tube out, and were able to transfer him to a civilian hospital. So again, these are very severe cases, but we now know that we can actually do quite a lot for them. But this is just where the story begins. This is just where the story begins. You would ask yourself again, always, how did this happen? Well, it's pretty straightforward how this happened. It was an explosive blast. Yes, we have TBI from the usual things, such as falls and motor vehicle accidents, but in today's war, this is what we get. We get explosive blasts. And I want to share with you what explosive blast looks like. This is a small, this is actually work being done by my research group, but this is a 20 kilogram charge. There, as you'll see, a big fireball, and what I want you to look at is, and don't concentrate on the fireball, but look at the leading edge of that fireball, and you'll see what is really, for now, we're finding is really one of the fundamental mechanisms. Bang, and you see this? Look at the air being perturbed. That's a shock wave. But also look down here. See the shock wave? It just bounced off the ground and also bounced up. These are 2x4s. That are stacked up there. And so this shockwave, even though if you're not in the fireball and you're outside of it, that shockwave keeps coming and coming and coming and really is, in fact, the basis, we believe, of the traumatic injuries that we're seeing today. That looks great. That's a laboratory. That's what the lab looks like. But let's take a look at what it really is, what the young men and women that we have actually in harm's way right now, what they're faced with. And what you'll see here is this is an army convoy out here. This is Iraq. You got the paved roads, you got the power lines, all that. This is just a regular truck, a civilian truck, who happens to be right now in the way. They're bunching up as they're not supposed to, but they bunched up, and you'll see this truck pull off to the side, and of course, you'll see the IED. But this is really a very typical Iraq-based IED. And so you saw the lab-based explosive. Well, that's 20 kilos. You can imagine what that is. That's a 155 kilogram blast. And so you can imagine the amount of trauma that goes on there. And that was then. What about now? This is Afghanistan. This is a captured video that I'm going to share with you. This is an Al-Qaeda ambush team, all right? And these are our soldiers. This was taken just last year. And that's a rocket-propelled grenade. Oh, I'm sorry. That was a rocket-propelled grenade. And this is a heavy machine gun. And this is the Al-Qaeda ambush team. And what you'll see is that very shortly, there's a speaking in the background, that's all. And so what I want to show you is this is in the mountains that separate Pakistan from Afghanistan. And these are serious mountains. As you can see, that's the road. You can tell how far away these guys are. But that's a very common road, having been on many, Afghani road. No pavement, hugging the side of a mountain. And the way material gets from village to village is actually by truck. They have no railroad. They have no airfields. So the only way supplies get from village to village is by truck. And you'll see over here, this little blue truck over here, that is a jingle truck. And that's the last jingle truck of a column of 10 jingle trucks. And the villages that are tucked hither, thither, and yon depend on these little blue trucks to bring them supplies, such as cloth and some food and the like. To protect them, we actually have 3 armored Humvees up front, we have the 10 jingle trucks, and we have 3 Humvees in the back. But look at this road. These guys are told to scrape the right side of their door frame so that they know they're close enough, because you drift too far to the left, and that's not good. And you can see that there's the ruts are about 18 inches, so they're kind of bouncing up and down, bouncing up and down. So the convoy has kind of gone past now, and this is the back end of it. The medic, you should know, is in the very back Humvee. And I want you to keep an eye on this front Humvee right here, because that's really what it is. So the convoy's gone by, and these guys are just driving along. All they're trying to do is protect this little convoy. And as they drive along, he's going to get hit by an IED, as you'll see. All right, so that wounded 2 of the people inside the Humvee, and the other 2 were actually okay. Now they're under heavy fire. You can hear the machine gun, just little puffs of white smoke. So the medic is back here, and there's no way that he can climb out and go get to help the two wounded fellows. And these two, and you saw how far away they're filming, they're fighting for their lives. And so these are Americans. This is what's going on today. And you can see little puffs of machine gun smoke that are going back and forth, and you'll constantly hear the firing of the rockets. And what's happening in here is the two healthy fellows are trying to get control of the vehicle so they can get moving, because these guys cannot back up, they can't go forward, and the helicopters can't get to them because they're in this very narrow pass. So they really just have to, they're going to die, or they have to find some way to get themselves out of there. Now, if you notice, they got the vehicle going again. So the two healthy guys got the vehicles, and they just got hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. So that killed two of them, and the two other remaining guys are wounded. And so now these two back Humvees are now really seriously fighting hard for their lives. This one is the machine gunner in this one, believe it or not, is still returning fire, even though he's completely surrounded by smoke and all this, and he's firing back. And Al-Qaeda definitely wants to kill them all. There's no doubt about it. So the back machine, that middle machine gunner, fortunately was able to find where those guys were coming from, and he neutralized the ambush team. The medic at that point leaped out of the Humvee, climbed over the middle Humvee, got to the destroyed vehicle, pulled the two wounded guys out and the two dead guys out, and then what they did was they pushed that Humvee off the side of the cliff. They brought the bodies and the two wounded fellows back to the other Humvees, and then they finished the drive because there was no air extraction. There was no air extraction. It took them 6 hours to get out of that valley to a point where the helicopters were going to pick them up and take them out. So if you ask what the urgency of what we are doing is, that's what the urgency of what we're doing is. And these are just regular Americans. These are not any, these are the kids who live, you know, probably in your own neighborhood. So that is our urgency. So what do we do in a situation like this? What we look for is, what can we learn from good, best medical practice? And where we are in best medical practice today is unfortunately inconsistent. If you look at traumatic brain injury, the diagnosis, particularly mild TBI, is not only is it inconsistent, it's actually really quite poor. In fact, only 15% of mild TBI victims are seen by a physician. The vast majority is seen on the side of a playing field by a coach, by a parent, or by some other layperson. It may never even see a physician. So because of that, the epidemiology is unknown, the disease natural history is unknown. The CDC says that there's about 500,000 mild traumatic brain injuries per year, and even they can see that that's low by a huge number, and the number actually is projected to be more like 8 million. So we are really have no standard approach. There's no specific neurotreatments in clinical practice. All the neuroprotectants we want, there have been many, many, many that have been looked at in preclinical trials. They're very, very effective in saving a rat. They're absolutely miserable for saving a human being. So, you know, if you want to save a rat, that's all fine and well, but typically if I found a rat in my basement, I'd hit it with a shovel, but that's okay. But it's not because of lack of effort. I mean, we have probably some of the finest scientists in the country, and the NIH, the DOD, has spent billions of dollars investing into trying to find things. Really what we have to ask ourselves is there a better way? And I think that's what this frontier is very good at. Is there a better way? It's not for lack of genius. It's not for lack of investment, but there is a better way. And so that really begs the issue. So what do we do? What we have done right now is we try to do the best that we can. And what we try to do then is learn from what we can from the war, learn what we know from best civilian practice, and start to put it into place and evolve it continuously. So one thing we've done is we've created the first large system-wide approach to concussion. We have a concussion diagnostic tool that's in the field right now. It's called the MACE, Military Acute Concussion Evaluation. It is a validated tool. Embedded with this is a standard assessment of concussion, the SAC, which was developed, honestly, for the NFL. So we have that. We've developed clinical practice guidelines for TBI care, which really is the basis of the management of the soldiers who have been wounded. In addition, we've also created clinical practice guidelines for field management of combat-related head injury, and also clinical practice guidelines for moderate to severe TBI. And we also have return-to-duty requirements. One of the most important things, and that's why I'm so happy to see an eminence such as Dr. Hyman here, Dr. Landis, and, of course, Congressman Kennedy and Senator Cleland and Congressman and others here, because it takes a top-down level. The reason why we're able to do this in the military is because the highest level of command has decided this must happen. This must happen. So what they ended up doing is, to make sure that it happened, was they sent these five fellows, of which I'm one of them, called the gray team, out in the theater. Now, it's called the gray team. People think because of gray matter, you know, in the brain. It's not. It's because we're all old. And so, so they were sent out, and the idea was is to find out what was being done and how to make it better. And we came back, made a report. It was endorsed by the Secretary of Defense. It was sent back down. And when we sent back a second time, 6 months later, there was 100% compliance. And it's because it takes leadership, such as we have in this room, as we have leadership back there to make this happen. But so it can be done. It can be done. And as I said to you before, it is standardized treatment paradigm from battlefield through all levels of care. Most critically, and the point that I want to stress right now, is mandatory TBI screening. Mandatory TBI screening. What does that mean? It means that all occupants of the vehicle ahead and behind of a damaged vehicle must be screened, and anybody who's on foot patrol is within 50 meters of a blast must be screened. Why do we do that? Because these are not patients that come to you. These are patients we must go to. We had to change the paradigm of expecting somebody to report and say, I am hurt, when we realize that they may not know they're hurt, particularly the PTSD patients. We have to go find them, and that's the point. Once we find them, we have a whole paradigm of care, and that care is based upon what we've worked with the VA on evidence-based practice. Can it be better? Absolutely. But we have to start someplace, and this is a place to start, and we want to build on it. And I point out, it's just not pharmacotherapy. It is also non-pharmacologic therapy is also in these clinical practice guidelines. We're very proud of that. And finally, we had to empower the first provider. We have to start moving the hospital out front, and that's what we did over here. And we want to share our experiences. So all these experiences have been published. They're out in the open literature because we want to be able to participate in improving civilian care as the civilians also improve our care. But as I said to you before, it's the beginning, because where it goes now is research, research, research. The epidemiology, all the way from the molecular genetics, all the way up into more drug development and therapeutic development, we have just begun. And only an effort like this is going to work. And if you want to have a moonshot, it wasn't the moonshot that mattered. My mom was actually one of the engineers back in those days. And it wasn't the moonshot that mattered. It was actually watching the man land on the moon, walk on the moon, and then come home again. Coming home is kind of hard. Getting them out there is okay, but getting them home is kind of tough. All right? So what we want to do here is, what is the moonshot? I would submit to you the moonshot is restoration of these wounded veterans. Let it be that. I want to end with my last patient. I spoke of TBI, I did not talk about spinal cord injury. I want to share with you this one patient, my last thing. This was a soldier that I saw in Iraq. He was driving along, he got hit by an IED, he was blown out of the cupola of his Humvee, he was a machine gunner. Landed on his back, he was broken in two places. Came to the combat support hospital and I saw him and evaluated him. And he most definitely had a broken back in T4, T5, and he was in Asia E, he had no deficits. And I just looked him right in the eye, and I said, soldier, I says, you know, you have a broken back, you're going home. I'm going to send you home. And he started to cry. He just broke down and started to cry. And I said to him, I said, son, there's nothing to cry about. I said, you incurred an injury facing the enemy. You're a brave young man. You're going to get a Purple Heart. There is nothing to cry about. You should be proud. And he grabs my tunic, and he says, Colonel, he says, do not send me home. And I said, why? And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, sir, do you know what I am when I'm home? I said, no, what are you? He says, I'm a reservist. I'm an assistant manager of a fast food restaurant. But here, I get to help people build a new nation of their own. That level of nobility was just blew me away. We talk about the greatest generation. You know what the greatest generation were? They were young Americans sent to war. And you know what? This generation are young Americans being sent to war. And they are you, and you are they. Why do I say that? Because if you went to go do their job, you would do it for the reasons he's doing it. Forget the famous people, the wealthy people. Forget the Wall Street bankers and the oil billionaires. Forget what they think. Who cares what they think? What you want is what he thinks. Because he's who the Iraqis see. He's who the Afghanis see. He's who the Libyans will see. He's who whoever we send will see. He is your children and how they would behave. It is that level of nobility that defines America. I truly believe that deep in my heart. So in the end, if we want to go to the moon, this moon is a good moon to go to. And I believe this, bottom line, is that the most wonderful thing that you can do is to help these young, fine people do the noble work that they are doing, and in that way, it becomes our nobility. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was absolutely terrific synopsis of the big problems that we have over here. And I just wanted to close with a couple of words on the on how our how neurosciences can richly overlay onto this problem. And as we know, this is a very complex and huge spectrum of disorders that can happen. You've heard about 3 to 4 of these problems today. But I just want to point out to you, and you'll hear in the rest of the conference, other topics that will come to bear on this important problem that neuroscience is facing. We know that there is a course of injury that goes from acute, subacute, recovery, and chronic. And over time, we see different kinds of mechanisms that are involved in this process. There's early injury, and neuroscience is coming to bear on mechanisms of injury that we are understanding from animal models. There's much being done in animal models and cell culture systems that are now being actually taken to the human with our advent of neuroimaging and neurophysiological testing. The subacute and subacute period is filled with other mechanisms that are also tractable and can actually also be targets for therapy and intervention. And lots is being discovered around those possibilities. Rehabilitation and recovery is yet another phase that you'll be hearing more about tomorrow, where there are ongoing changes of remapping, rewiring the nervous system, synaptic plasticity, but new problems that occur, including the beginnings of what will become chronic epilepsy, Alzheimer's down later on is higher risk in this group, PTSD and addiction. And bringing to bear neuroscience, we're able to, with now in this tractable population, think about neuroimaging, neurophysiology, new neuroprotective treatments that can be applied early. The subacute period, as we've seen, can hold new biomarkers that will tell us, predict us how patients will do with respect to some of the chronic consequences. Rehabilitation and recovery is a whole new field now with the brain-machine interface, prosthetics, new drugs that might accelerate, and new behavioral modifications that might accelerate the remapping process. And finally, the chronic sequelae that we face also is now being actually addressed by neuroscience. So many, many phases of this course of traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury that these veterans are facing can be actually addressed by our neuroscience. So it is a focused population. They are in the hands of wonderful people like Colonel Ling. These are findings in research can be translated very rapidly to this population, as he's shown. There is much to be learned, but about the early traumatic brain injury and treatment thereof, you've heard. There's a lot about the psychiatric consequences that we heard Dr. Hyman talk about earlier, such as PTSD, depression, suicidality, chronic pain, substance abuse. Lots of technology is being applied to this process, and there's going to be enormous contributions to civilian medicine, as we've spoken about before, relating to these same kinds of disorders. So I want you to think about these as we go through the conference tomorrow, and even tonight we're going to be hearing about sports-related concussions and brain injury, and this is very relevant to this population as well. It's all connected. So thank you very much, and we'll take questions.
Thank you, panel. Please give them a round of applause. Thank you again. We have one final presentation. We are very fortunate to have the Chancellor of UCLA, Gene Block, who also is a neuroscientist. I now know a lot more about circadian rhythms, having listened to him. And just if you've ever studied that, my main mode of travel now is always to go west, because rats who go east die much earlier, and he can prove that. But Gene has a very special invitation. He's agreed to shorten his presentation, given the time that we have, to just talk about a very important invitation he wants to deliver to you. So please welcome Chancellor Gene Block.
Thank you, Garen. And I was warned that I might have to have a very short form at the end of the day. What has been a dazzling day, and I was just thinking back, if we think back 10 years, the difference in the presentations, the amount of progress in the last decade is really staggering. And of course, we expect that in the next decade. Great meeting. But the meeting's a beginning, and there's a lot of advocacy ahead. I mean, this is an effort to develop a new public-private partnership to fund neuroscience, as it has to be funded, to make rapid progress and continue that progress for a long time. So there needs to be more discussion, and we're going to hold another annual meeting, and I've been asked to host that at UCLA. I'm happy to do that, so I think May 24th, 25th. Thank you. We will gather again to review progress and see how things are going, and I can guarantee you will not need an umbrella, and you will probably not even need a warm coat. So we welcome you. Thank you for inviting me. What a great conference. Thank you.